welcome to this week's W3C CCG meeting. So today we're very glad to have our Manu here to kind of lead the discussion on the selective disclosure for data integrity. But before we get to that, I just want to quickly go through some admin stuff. First of all, just a quick code of ethics and professional conduct reminder. Just make sure that we are respectful to each other's comments and opinions. Next, anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to CCG work items must be member of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. So if you have any questions on that, or if you have problems and troubles creating a W3C account, feel free to just reach out to me, myself, or other co-chairs. All the meeting minutes and audio recordings, these meetings are being recorded and automatically transcribed, and all the minutes and recordings will be published within the next few days. We use GC Chat to queue the speakers during the call. You can type in Q plus to add yourself to the queue, or Q minus to remove. And you can type in Q question mark to see who is in the queue. All right, any introductions and reintroductions? If you're new to the community, or if you haven't been engaging with the community and want to kind of re-engage with it, feel free to just unmute and introduce yourself.
Hi all, this is Matt Gee from BrightHive, long-time listener, first-time caller for this group, looking forward to it.
Great. Thank you, Matt. Welcome. Any other introductions or reintroductions? All right, announcements and reminders. Bonnie, please.
So I've got an exciting announcement. Let me go ahead and share my screen really quickly, if I can find it. So the state of California has just released a very big pilot to California residents using verifiable credentials and decentralized identifiers. So this is the California DMV app. The California DMV app allows you to hold mobile driver's licenses, and it also lets you do digital age verification. Specifically, it uses the True Age program, which uses verifiable credentials and decentralized identifiers and data integrity and a bunch of other stuff that we're standardizing at W3C. This is a big deal because the pilot includes 1.5 million people in the state of California. This is a huge deployment of W3C technology, verifiable credentials. This image you see over here on the left here, that QR code is a verifiable credential. It's a W3C encoded, digitally signed verifiable credential using technologies that all of us here have been working on for many, many years. That's huge, right? Because they're going to start out with a population of 1.5 million people, and they're going to grow it to 24 million people. Anyone that drives in the state of California or has a driver's license will have the ability to deliver verifiable credentials through the California DMV app. So that's item one. That's a huge pilot. You can read more about it. Actually, here, let me go ahead and drop the links here into the chat channel. You can read more about it on the California DMV webpage, where they cover the True Age program. The True Age program, the other big news here, is with the announcement that the California DMV app is live. True Age is also announcing that they are very much into production deployment at this point. In fact, True Age has been in production since January of this year, but we were waiting on the California announcement to note this. So everyone in this, you know, this is a huge kind of watershed moment, I think, for people in this community. This is, you know, in production, deployed, real citizens are using it. The TrueAge program uses a very aggressive privacy, stance, meaning there's no personally identifiable information in the verifiable credential. It's tokenized, single-use tokens. Much better than handing over your driver's license, which has, you know, 35 pieces of PII. So there we go. That's the, announcement for this week.
Well, that's amazing. And by the way, like, do they also support mobile, like, MVL, like MDoc kind of the format, or just the verifiable credentials?
Yes. So California is the first state to basically go, we're just going to support multiple, formats. So they support MDL. That's that you use that if you want to board an airplane. And they support verifiable credentials, for the age verification, portion of this.
Got it.
So, yeah, so they're very much multi issuance at this point. They're basically saying, we don't know which one of these formats are going to win in the end, and we're just going to support all of them. And it's, you know, and it's possible to do so. This is a example of it.
Cool. So it kind of depends on the wallet, like what does the wallet want to support, basically, right? Implement.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, both the issuer, right? So the issuers here are interesting. The California DMV wallet, is the wallet. It's an app. But it's got multiple issuers associated with it, state of California, and then the National Association of Convenience Stores, retailers, that association issues the age credential. So this is also an example of like multi-sourced credentials from a variety of different places being put into the same wallet, and being used for different purposes.
Cool. Thank you. And by the way, do you know anybody who's like actually being instrumental in pushing this initiative that we can invite to talk about it?
So the wallet is something that Spruce, so, you know, Wayne Chang, ex-chair for this group, is the CEO of Spruce. So bringing Wayne in to talk about it would be good. And then the TrueAge folks, that's us. So we built, architected, deployed the TrueAge system in, that's Digital Bazaar. So we deployed that architecture in the US. So yeah, happy to chat more about it. We should definitely have Wayne and them come in and talk about it as well.
Will do. All right. I'll kind of connect with you and Wayne offline. Thanks. All right. Any other announcements or reminders? Kalia, please.
We've got the Internet Identity Workshop coming up in 2 weeks. On the morning of Monday, there's a Open Wallet Foundation, event for developers, and anyone can come, but it's oriented towards developers. I did post the link to the list, but I will repost it here. It's from 9 to noon, at a yet to be determined location, but we'll figure that out. And, I also wanted to say I'm going to be at Identity Week America next week in DC, and I actually have free tickets to give away if you want a free ticket, if you're in the area, or nearby. I'm happy to send you a link to register if you want to back channel me.
Thanks, Clea. Any other announcements and reminders? Bonnie, please.
Yeah, I guess I don't know if anyone's gotten a report out from what happened at the W3C technical plenary 2 weeks ago. But there was the other really interesting thing is that there was a very heavy interest by the browser manufacturers, Apple and Google and Microsoft's browser team and the Android team all met up at the W3C technical plenary to talk about how to support W3C verifiable credentials and mobile driver's licenses, through a browser API. So this is all about, you know, open wallet selection, and invocation. There's some, proposals that are kind of flying around from one of them's from Apple, the other one's from Google. But the outcome of those discussions was really positive in that the Google Chrome team, at least, has stated that they're very, interested in providing, open wallet selection in, the web browser to deliver things like, you know, mobile driver's licenses or verifiable credentials. They want to stay format agnostic, protocol agnostic. It's still a bit, you know, an active discussion. You know, whether or not to support both native apps and web apps is a part of the discussion. But I mean, there were like, you know, 36 browser core people in the meeting. You had program managers from Google and Android, from Google Chrome and Android, you know, and Apple's browser in attendance. So they are following, and of course, a number of us in this community have been talking with them directly. They are following some of the stuff, some of the groundwork that was laid with the credential handler API, Chappie. But they're also looking for inspiration from, you know, the mobile driver's license stuff that Apple's been doing and the web payment stuff that has been done in the past. So this is another kind of big movement where the browser vendors have kind of woken up and gone, oh, we need to be a part of this. There are now weekly meetings in the Web Incubator community group. So this is another W3C community group called YCG. That is usually where the browser vendors test out ideas before they try to create working groups at W3C on it. There is a plan for something called an origin trial in the Google Chrome browser starting in probably about 5 months. And an origin trial in Google Chrome is where they build functionality in and only allow it to be accessed by certain, you know, people, certain demographics, or they hide it behind a browser invocation flag. But at that point, they have real running code able to move things like mobile driver's licenses and verifiable credentials. They run those with the intent purpose of shutting them down. But, you know, they run them to get like real world data back on how people are going to use the API and things of that nature. So a number of us in this community are going to participate in that origin trial to, ensure that, at least the CCGs, some of the CCGs interests are, you know, represented there, as well as the verifiable credentials working groups, interests are represented there. That's it for that item.
Thanks, Bonnie. Camille?
Just if folks have not seen it, I think there is a announcement from the OpenID Foundation that they released a new white paper called Human-Centric Digital Identity for Government Officials. I happened to read that, and I found it to be really a worthwhile read. I think that there's a lot of work that went into creating the paper, getting a variety of different perspectives. I know folks like Kalia, Dave Birch, and many others in the community actively contributed to that paper. So I would highly recommend reading it. I found it to be really interesting and a very holistic look at, the current state of identity across the globe, and a very worthwhile read. So highly recommend. I'll put a link in the chat for where people can find it.
Thank you. Thank you, Emil. Any other announcements or reminders? All right. Any updates to the work items? All right. So let's get to the main agenda. So I would say 2-3 months back, Manu has kind of shared this selected disclosure for data integrity with the CCG mailing list. actually kind of want to invite him to kind of talk about it, but at that time we have quite a bit of speakers already lined up and already invited. So only now we have the chance to kind of discuss this idea, and also he has the presentation ready to kind of go over that. So thank you, Manu, for taking the time to kind of present it, and please take the floor.
Awesome. Thank you, Harrison. Let me go ahead and share my screen. Go into slideshow mode. Can folks see that?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Harrison, for inviting us to speak. I've also got Dave Longley here, who did an enormous amount of the technical work on this selective disclosure mechanism, this approach for data integrity. Just to give folks a bit of a background who might not know, we are a part of the credentials community group here at the World Wide Web Consortium. We incubate technology here. And once we feel like that technology is ready to go standards track at W3C, we kind of push it onto, we work on a charter, we push the technology kind of into an official working group at W3C. Most recently, the latest working group that we had a part, meaning the credentials community group, had a part in creating was the second iteration of the W3C verifiable credentials working group. And in scope for that working group were a couple of items. The first one was, maintain verifiable credentials, release a 2.0 version of it, make it better, that kind of thing. And the other work item that went along with it was securing mechanisms for verifiable credentials. So as everyone knows, the verifiable credential, the thing that makes it verifiable, is that you've got some kind of digital signature on it, some kind of digital proof that tells you who signed it, who issued it, who's making those statements. So securing mechanisms were in scope, and there are multiple ways of doing it. There's the VCJOT stuff, there's the SDJOT stuff, and there's a mechanism called data integrity. So we're going to be looking at that data integrity approach today. And so all this to say that this is work that is actively being standardized at W3C in an official working group. Feel free to interrupt at any point here. I will definitely stop at certain points through here and see if there are any questions. The talk is largely kind of like a high level introduction to selective disclosure, with a very strong focus on a specific, mechanism. But, any form of selective disclosure, I think, is fair game to discuss here. So if you have any questions on any of that stuff, please let us know. Okay, so let's get started. One big disclaimer here is that all I'm trying to do here is just introduce data integrity selective disclosure schemes and provide some benefits and drawbacks. This is not meant to be like my selective disclosure mechanism is better than your selective disclosure mechanism. Let's have a big giant argument about it. This is just kind of like information sharing. I stayed away from a comparison because that tends to get people's kind of hackles up. So, this is meant to just be here's what we have and here's what it does. And a discussion around that. Just the set of things that we're going to cover today, just a really brief overview of selective disclosure and what it is, go over some selective disclosure use cases, look at a life cycle for selective disclosure. So there's this three-party model that we have, which party does what when selective disclosure is done, what are things to look out for. And then we'll go on into how it works from a conceptual standpoint. So that's going to be like a really high level, like no techno jargon, anything, just like fundamentally, what are we doing here? How does it work? And then we'll go into a deep dive if we have time or if people are interested. So that's kind of what we're going to cover, over the next 15 to 20 minutes, I think. Is there anything on here that folks would like to cover that, I mean, it's fine if it's out of left field, but was there anything you were hoping that would be covered? And you're not seeing it on here that we're going to cover it?
No, this is a great agenda.
Okay. All right. All right. Then let's get started. What is selective disclosure? It's a super simple, straightforward concept, right? So the idea here is that you've got some document, some data, and you're going to hand that data over to a holder. So, you know, someone that's going to hold on to that data, and you want to empower them to only reveal specific information in that document to a verifier. The easiest way to think about this is like you've got a driver's license, and if somebody, you know, if you're going to go rent a car, they may not need to know your everything on that driver's license, right? Or if you're trying to, and I stay away from the proving age thing because I think that's a very complex use case. If all you're trying to do is share some information in that driver's license, then handing all of it over is not what you want to do. You want a way to selectively disclose what's in that driver's license. So that's all selective disclosure is we're trying to empower people to not overshare information and data like they do today. And that's it in a nutshell. That's all selective disclosure is. It certainly gets more complex, from there, but, you know, that's kind of, what we're, dealing with today. Okay. So what are some, use cases, that we can think of, you know, with respect to selective disclosure? One of them is proving that you're a citizen of a particular country without revealing your address. So let's say you have, something like, a passport or a permanent resident card. You may not want to share all the information, like what your birth country was, your height and weight, or that kind of stuff. If all you need to do is prove that you are a citizen of a particular country. Another use case is proving that you're an employee of a particular company without revealing your name or position. So, you know, saying that you are, an employee of Utopia Corp, instead of revealing that you have a very sensitive position in that organization, is a desirable thing to do if you have an employee ID card. But, you know, selective disclosure does not only apply to people or identity documents for people. If you think of shipping manifests, like the contents of a shipment. So let's say that you need to, you have a shipment, and you need to reveal where the shipment is going, without revealing the contents of the shipment. So, and that has a, you know, pretty direct analogy to the way shipping works today. You put an address on the outside of the package, and whoever's shipping it really doesn't see inside the box. They just, send it to where it's going, right? So if we want to take that thing digital, but use, you know, a single document, selective disclosure helps there. If we look at payments, revealing the sender and receiver of a payment to make sure that they're not on a sanction list or, something of that nature, without revealing exactly what's being paid for. So sending and receiving payment without understanding, you know, what the goods that are being exchanged are, you know, is another legitimate selective disclosure use case. And then of course this proving that you're over a certain age and are licensed to drive without sharing your PII. So the use case here is like a car rental, or temporary car rental, or even golf cart rental. You know, there are vehicles that you can operate over a certain age. And all you really need to do is prove that, you are a license to operate the motor vehicle without really revealing anything else. So these are, you know, some fairly straightforward examples of selective disclosure. Again, what we're trying to do is protect protect people's privacy. And it's not just people, right? It's protect people's privacy, protect an organization's privacy when they're interacting in a transaction. Christopher Allen had this you know, interesting thing about progressive disclosure. The idea here being that, you know, when you start out in a transaction, you probably want to share the absolute minimum necessary to get to the next level, with, you know, more and more disclosure happening as you feel more and more comfortable with the entity that you're interacting with. There are also just I know everyone in this community like understands like GDPR and the privacy, you know, California Consumer Privacy Act and all that kind of stuff. There's regulation now, that is, pushing, organizations to collect less and less information, to only collect the information that is necessary for, the transaction, you know, if regulations require the collection of certain information, only collect that, don't over-collect information. So selective disclosure helps with all of those use cases. Did I miss a use case that folks are interested in? Do you disagree with any of these use cases? I'll hold for a couple of beats. Matt, you're in the queue.
Yeah, just one that comes up for us a lot is selective disclosure for pooled analytics. So like being able to opt in or out of research studies, especially in true in education, being able to say, yeah, you can use my data as a student to learn more about how learning is happening. So love, you know, thinking about the use case of pooling data and ensuring that the disclosure or the allowed use of that data consent mechanism travels with the data is very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. The other thing I that is somewhat related to that that's come up in the past is use of data for, you know, training AI, which is, you know, it's a touchy subject right now, right? I mean, nobody wants to have their data be used, to train an AI without their consent. And even then you may want to only selectively disclose some parts of what you're doing, or you might want to blind, you know, the data that you're sending over entirely, to make sure that only the data that you want to, you know, be used to train it, is being used. So research studies and sharing of information, certainly. Any other use cases that folks All right, I'm gonna go on. But yeah, so hopefully this gives, you know, everyone an understanding of like why people are so interested in selective disclosure. It's not, you know, ooh, cool, whiz-bang, you know, new technology, cryptography. It's data privacy regulation, I think, is driving a lot of this stuff, and people are starting to understand how their data is being used and don't necessarily like how it's being used in many cases. Okay, so how does selective disclosure work with verifiable credentials? This is this three-party model that we keep talking about and have worked on for many years. Standardize, you've got an issuer, a holder, and a verifier. The issuer issues a verifiable credential to a holder who then stores that in like a digital wallet. And then they go to another party, which is a verifier, who asks for some variation of that information from the issuer. And then the holder presents something to the verifier. Using selective disclosure doesn't change that model at all, and it doesn't change the flow of information at all. The only difference largely is in the cryptography that is used to secure the verifiable credential. The issuer has to knowingly use a selective disclosure scheme when they hand it over to the holder. The holder then sees that the issuer has given them something that they can selectively disclose. And so when the verifier requests something, the verifier also has to request it in a way that says, I am okay with a selectively disclosed a piece of information. The thing to understand here is that the issuer and the verifier have to buy into this ecosystem, and that can be challenging, right? Sometimes issuers are they don't know any better and they just issue a basic thing. Sometimes they can't, don't have the technological capabilities to issue a verifiable credential as a selectively disclosed thing. And sometimes the verifier, and this is what people are, a bit concerned about, and this is why we're, doing work on trust frameworks and verifiable verifiers. Sometimes the verifier won't give you the option. They'll say, no, I want all this information. I don't support selective disclosure, right? And so that's the thing to keep in mind here, is that it will require a good bit of pressure on issuers and verifiers to make sure that they do the right thing. And largely, again, regulation is driving a lot of that. The Consumer Privacy Acts, GDPR is trying to really put pressure on organizations to do the right thing and don't collect more than what you need. Okay, so let's see. There was a performance slide in here. I've taken that out just because that raises people's hackles. Let's start talking about data integrity and selective disclosure, specifically the scheme that's being worked on in the Verifiable Credential Working Group. There are a couple of requirements there. One of them was we had to provide a mechanism that supported NIST-approved cryptography. So there's some other selective disclosure mechanisms like BBS that is not recognized directly by NIST, and people don't feel like it's mature enough. So if you want to really, say, hey, look, we're using this to prove cryptography, full stop, this selective disclosure mechanism for data integrity is something we wanted to, we needed to be able to say that, right, so that governments could adopt this. We needed to support mandatory disclosure of specific properties. So when an issuer issues something, let's say that there's a revocation list associated with the credential. Well, you shouldn't allow a holder to selectively disclose that whether or not the credential is revoked. So you, from a mandatory standpoint, have to disclose, whether or not the credential is revoked or not. We wanted really small initial proof sizes, between 7,000 to 4,000 bytes, to store in the digital wallet. So, we're trying to make it so that, what's stored in a digital wallet is reasonable, from, a proof size perspective. And then for disclosure, we wanted really small as we could get them disclosure sizes, because, there are some use cases that are data constrained and some of the selective disclosure, schemes have really big signatures. So we optimized for really small, disclosure proof sizes, disclosure proof sizes. Basically, it starts small. So the less you share, the smaller the signature size. The more you share, the more the signature size grows. So about 128 bytes per claim that you're expressing. This is an example. We tried to take what a driver's license or a permanent resident card would look like under this disclosure scheme. So the lines are showing how big the signature size is for a selectively disclosed scheme. So as you can see here, with one claim revealed, we're down at 270 to 300 bytes. And as each new claim is revealed, your signature size grows, but it never gets, super crazy big or anything like that. So anyway, there's a, pretty standard linear curve to how big the signature sizes are. Okay, so let's talk about how it works at a super high level. Again, this is kind of the journey here. The issuer has to digitally sign something using the selective disclosure scheme. They hand it over to the holder, which understands that they're holding onto a verifiable credential with the selective disclosure scheme. And then the verifier has to ask for a subset of that credential. Like, I want to see your driver's license, but the only thing I want to see on it is whether or not you have a driver's license at all. I don't want to see the driver's license number. I don't want to see, I want to see the issuing state, but I don't want to see where you live, for example. And so then there's a, you know, protocol where the holder selectively discloses that stuff to the verifier, and the verifier can check the signature, just the properties it asks for. Okay. So how does it work? Let's look at a pretty simple credential. This is an employee use case. So this is an employee credential. The employee credential is valid from June 2023 to June 2024. The subject is Jane Doe. And Jane Doe has some information in here. Jane's employee ID is this number here. Jane's job title is a comptroller. She works in the accounting division, and her employer's name is Example Corporation, right? So this is a verifiable, this is a verifiable credential, the types of claims you'd see in a verifiable credential. And we want to make this selectively disclosable. So how do we do that? Well, the first step, at least with data integrity, is we canonicalize. So we have to take these statements and put them in a certain order, so that we know, you know, which field we're, when we reveal a certain field, the same field, you know, is understood to be revealed at the verifier thing. So this green thing happening over here on the left is we have just kind of sorted, the data, right? Using, you know, a canonicalization scheme. So that's step one, is you put it in order, put it in a list, in order. Step two is you sign every single statement. So you put the data in order, and then for each line here, you sign it. There's a bit of a hand wave going on there. You know, some of these statements you're going to group together and say, you must disclose these things, group them all together, sign them once, and then you can select ones to be selectively disclosable. So for example, the validity dates, mandatorily disclosed, right? You want to make sure that the validity of the credential is well known. But you may want to hide their employer ID or make that selectively disclosable. Okay, so step one is you canonicalize. Step two is you sign all the statements. Step three is you hand that whole signed credential over to the holder. So the holder receives this, it's digitally signed by the issuer, and they see that it's a selectively disclosable credential. And then the verifier asks for specific claims. So the verifier goes, hey, I need an employee credential from you stating your employer's name. I just want to know who your employer is and whether or not, you know, it's current. Just give me that information. I don't need to know your employer ID number. I don't need to know need to know your name, right? So you can think of this as like for building access. Is your employer in the building? You know, use an employee credential just with your employer's name to get access to the building. So when the holder creates this disclosure, the selectively disclosed verifiable credential, that's the only two things it includes in there. It says this VC is an employee credential and my employer is Example Corporation. And that's it. That's all they share, right? So that's that's a subset of what was originally created. Okay, and that's pretty much it at a high level. Let me pause to see if there are any questions here, and then we can get deep into the weeds if folks want.
Hey, Manya, I have a question. Like, why do you need the canonicalization like step? Like, and also, is there a specific order that you have to have?
That's a great question. So canonicalization allows us, so do you need it? Do you need it? It depends on your use case. So SDJOT, it's arguable whether or not SDJOT actually canonicalizes. So some people will argue like it doesn't canonicalize at all and you don't need it. Other people will argue that it's got a canonicalization mechanism in there. So most of these schemes do some kind of canonicalization. Some of them are more complex than the other. The reason that we canonicalize in data integrity is because it allows us to use the same signature when the verifiable credential is expressed in a variety of different formats. So JSON versus CBOR versus YAML. When we use canonicalization in the way that we do, we can make sure that the same signature applies across multiple different data formats. We can also stack signatures one on top of the other. So we can do a signature that uses standard NIST cryptography that's not selectively disclosable, and then we can add another signature that allows selective disclosure, and then we can add another signature that allows unlinkable signatures, and then we could in the future add another signature that does post-quantum signatures. That's a quantum safe signature. So canonicalization is this mechanism that we can use that gives us some advantages, with a drawback being that it's more complicated to do than you know, no canonicalization. Go ahead.
And by the way, canonicalization doesn't mean just like adding some order list there, right? It's a lot more than that. Is that correct? Because in your example, you just put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but it's probably more than that. Is that right?
Technically, it's more than that, but conceptually, it's not any different than that. Like canonicalizing a list and putting it in alphabetical order, that's canonicalization, right? So if you had a bunch of items and you just sorted by where, you know, by alphabetical order, that is an example of canonicalization. And the type of canonicalization we do for selective disclosure, is not really all that different from doing that.
Got it. And Claire, you're on the queue.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I'll echo what Manu said. BBS, some of that work that's been incubated at DIF, is not a standard with NIST. However, it's draft 03 on its way to becoming a standard at IETF. I just put the link in chat. And we're at the very early stages. Remember, it's a long road to crawl, walk, run with NIST to becoming a standard. But the BBS team is presenting to the NIST Crypto Reading Club on October 18th. So if you belong to that club, you can join or send me a message and I'll try to get you into that club. We just got the invitation, so I don't even know if it's open to the public, but it's very exciting news that we're initiating our discussions at NIST. Any questions? Thank you.
Thanks, Claire.
Yeah, and that is really fantastic news, Claire. One of the things I wanted to point out here is this selective disclosure mechanism works with NIST-approved crypto, and we are working with BBS as well. There's a mechanism that allows this selective disclosure stuff to work with the BBS mechanism that you were talking about, Claire, and we're pretty excited about that as well. So it's great news on the progress there.
All right, Matt, you're next in the queue.
Thanks. So I'm curious, is the canonicalization essentially trying to accomplish the same thing that I think the Fire API community has been trying to solve, the, like, how do you identify entities within, kind of within a claim? And there's a proposal by a group on interoperable universal resource identifiers, essentially like UUIDs instead of rank ordered numbers at the entity level. I'm curious, is that solving for the same problem? And if so, like, why go with a canonicalization over like a IURI?
Yeah, that's a great question, Matt. The short answer to that is no, that's not solving the same issue. I think that one has to do, and you'll have to forgive me, Fire, you know, I am familiar with the firework, but not following it closely. One of the big issues there was being able to just identify entities at all. That class of problem is like decentralized identifiers, UUIDs for specific people and entities, and things of that nature. Am I misreading kind of what you were saying?
Yeah, I'll post it in the chat. This is actually specifically how FireAPI, OpenEHR, et cetera, are implementing selective disclosure for medical records. So it's actually very specific to selective disclosure, okay. Not just like entity resolution generally in medical context. It's fine. I don't want to derail the conversation. I was just curious if it's the same, solving for the same problem, or if they're actually two separate problems within the context of selective disclosure.
That's really interesting. Yeah, and if you don't mind, if you could send that to the mailing list, I think that would be great to look at.
Great.
Awesome. Thanks, Matt.
And Paul, you're next in the queue.
Thanks. Hey, this is Paul. Is this approach following the idea of atomic credentials, basically? And don't you also need like an additional signature to group all of these 8 signatures together?
That's a great question. Hi, Paul. Good to hear you on the call. I wouldn't call it an atomic credential. I'd call it, you know, a bunch of atomic claims. And you're right. You do need another signature to tie them all together. So I can get into that here in a bit once we go through the kind of the excruciating detail part of it, and kind of show you how that, works there. So just to kind of respond to your question, the claims, a subset of the claims are atomic. They're single, you know, claims each. Those are the selectively disclosable bits. And then there's a chunk of claims that are mandatory. You must always reveal these statements. And then there is a signature that goes over all of it, that basically digitally signs all of it. And again, I'm hand-waving a bit over the details, but I'll get into the details here in a bit. Did that at least answer your question at a high level, Paul?
Yeah, kind of. Let's go ahead here.
Okay, all right. Or do we have a clear cue, Harrison?
Yes.
All right. Okay, I'll try to run through the excruciating detail here quickly. So this is a verifiable credential. This is a version 2 verifiable credential. It's the employee credential. So we're just doing the same credential here. The same example in the conceptual example. This is what the verifiable credential would look like. So this is Jane Doe, who has a certain employee ID number, job title, division, and their employer is Example Corporation. So we take this bare verifiable credential, we canonicalize it, and we bunch those statements into 2 sets of statements. One of them are the mandatory disclosure claims up here at the top. These are the things that Jane is always going to have to reveal because the issuer feels that this is must be revealed. And the issuer here has basically said, you must always reveal me, the issuer, because the verifier can't trust the VC without that, and then the validity dates, and then the type of credential, right? But your selectively disclosed claims, and Paul, this is where it's like every single one of these lines is a separate statement with a separate signature. Your selective disclosure your claims is this list here, right? And these are both canonicalized. These lists are canonicalized. And so we're going to sign all these mandatory disclosure claims in one blob. And then each one of these selective disclosure claims is going to get its own signature. So one signature for all the mandatory disclosure claims here at the top. And then one signature per statement down here at the bottom. And that allows Jane to selectively disclose each one of these items here. The signature itself that we hand over to the holder has what we call a base signature, And that base signature signs over everything else here. So Paul, this is the, you know, the bundled thing that, you were, I think, alluding to. There is an ephemeral, public key that's used just to do the selective, selective signatures. And the ephemeral key is signed over with the base signature. So this is the issuer's signature here. There's an HMAC key, that we use to do some privacy preserving, computations on blank node identifiers. This is a complex topic that I'm going to not get into today, but the idea here is that we want to blind some of the information in the graph so that so it doesn't reveal information like, for example, the number of family members that you might have, the number of items in a shipment, that kind of thing. So that's what this HMAC key is for. And then there's a list of fields that you have to mandatorily disclose. So these are JSON pointers that point to specific fields. So you have to reveal the issuer, the type, the validity, dates here. And then we have a whole bunch of selective signatures. So this is for each one of those claims we want to selectively sign. There's a signature there for it. And the final signature size using a NIST approved P256 key is 643 bytes. So pretty small and compact there. And this is what the fully signed verifiable credential with a selective disclosure scheme looks like. This is the proof down here. So all that information is contained in this digital signature down here, and the rest of it just looks like a standard, you know, verifiable credential secured using data integrity. Now we go to the verifier. So what does the verifier ask for when they ask for a verifiable credential? So this is using a verifiable presentation request query by example. The credential query that they're sending over is we need you to verify your employer. That's what they want. And then the example query basically looks like the type of credential they want to receive. So the verifier says, I want you to give me a credential and it needs to take this kind of form. And we can see here is that, you know, they'd say the type has to be an employee credential. You've got to have an identifier for the credential subject, an employer identifier, and a name. And then they provide a challenge and a domain just to make sure that the thing can't be replayed. What the holder does is then they derive a new verifiable credential with a limited set of fields. So here, what they're doing is they are taking that original credential, which had a whole bunch of more fields in it, and they're minimizing the information, and they're generating a new proof. This is the signature that they're generating, and then they're going to send that over to the verifier. And when the verifier checks this, you know, there's an algorithm that's defined in a specification that's in the verifiable credential working group, and they will check, you know, this information and either get a thumbs up or thumbs down on the credential. So the credential that's handed over just looks like a, you know, minimized version with only certain fields exposed to the verifier. Okay, that's it for the presentation. I think we've got like maybe a couple of minutes left for QA. Any questions?
Paul, please.
First, a very simple question. The query language was not presentation exchange. What was that? Is that something specific to ECDSA?
No, there's a verifiable presentation request, which is a work item in the CCG that's using query by example. But I want to be clear, like the query language is separate from the selective disclosure mechanism. You could use multiple different types of query languages. So you don't have to use this one. This is just the one that we've implemented and used.
And a second question, do you have, what was the rationale to use individual signatures compared to the hashes? Is that required for the canonicalization, or was there another reason?
It's not required. It was a design choice. And Dave, you're here. I don't know if you want to kind of weigh in on that.
So the main reason for doing that is it reduces the disclosure proof sizes by a considerable amount. If you use the hash-based approach, you must disclose all of the hashes every time you do a disclosure proof. If you do the atomic signature approach, you only disclose the signatures that you that go along with the data that you are disclosing. So the sizes go down and enable use cases for when your data size is very constrained.
Yeah, for example, like we have use cases where we have to express this stuff in like a QR code, and you have to get, and you know, the idea behind selective disclosure is you're trying to minimize the amount of information you're sharing. So we were like, well, if we have to share less than 5 claims, then we need to make sure that the signature sizes are small enough that we can fit them in a QR code, or they can go over, you know, a single, data block in an NFC, transaction. So we were optimizing, for disclosure size, versus, you know, the other mechanism. Now, with that said, there is nothing preventing another data integrity crypto suite to take the approach that SDJOT took, right? So if what we want to do is the, you know, the reveal of hashes approach, we could fairly easily do that, with data integrity. We were just optimizing for, I think, a different set of use cases, than, SDJOT was optimizing for. Did that answer your question, Paul?
Yeah, that's kind of a good reason. I think it's interesting because there might be kind of a trade-off, because from the top of my head, I thought like, a hash has less than the 128 bytes. So initially, maybe per disclosure, there might be differences, but in the hash-based approach, you reveal all the hashes. So it kind of depends on how many claims you have and how many claims you reveal. And depending on that, that might impact the size of the two approaches.
Yes, you're absolutely right. There are certainly trade-offs there. Remember that with the SDJOT approach, you always have to reveal the full signature, you know, as well as all the hashes. So this is where we get into kind of compare contrast between the two. What we found out is that having run some of the tests with SDJOT, your signature sizes are usually really big. Your reveal sizes are like 2K to 4 kilobytes. In size for a thing the size of like a driver's license. And there's some use cases where like you're online or that doesn't matter, but there are constrained use cases that we're dealing with where that does, you know, matter. So these things, you know, it's a collection of trade-offs, right? And certain formats optimize for certain, approaches. One of the other, you know, trade-offs with the data integrity approach, this one specifically, is that you have to do multiple signatures, whereas with SDJOT, you only do one signature. And, you know, there are trade-offs there, meaning that, you know, you have to do multiple signatures with the selective disclosure data integrity mechanism, whereas with SDJOT, you don't have to. And so if your HSMs that you're using are expensive, then there are cost considerations that you might want to take into account. But, you know, we've again done cost analysis on it, and it tends to be really like a rounding error, doing multiple signatures versus a single one. All right. I note that we're at the top of the hour, unfortunately. I think, Phil, you had a question. I don't know.
Yeah, but at the top of the hour, I was just going to ask what the holder's experience is and all of this. But we can leave that.
Yeah. Well, you want to simplify it as much as possible and tell the holder that, you know, you're only releasing this information, right? There are a couple of good demos that are out there of mobile wallets doing selective disclosure. But you want to keep things as simple as possible for the individual. Tell them that, you know, hey, you're sharing your driver's license, but you're only sharing these 3 fields. And just let them, you know, communicate that to them.
Got it. Great presentation, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. All right, over to you, Harrison.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mommy. Your presentation is always amazing, so thanks a lot. All right, so this concludes this week's CCG meeting. We'll publish the meeting minutes and audio recordings in a few days. And if you have any questions, feel free to just message it in the email list. All right, thanks a lot.